Well, welcome for several of you. Welcome back for several more of you. We met yesterday, and one change, let me mention immediately, on the schedule originally, we were to meet for the third time tomorrow afternoon at 3:45, but we'll meet tomorrow morning, I believe at 10 o'clock.
10:30.
At 10:30.
Right.
At 10:30 tomorrow morning. So that'll be the third of our meetings tomorrow morning. Yesterday, we had the opportunity to talk. Let me change that. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to talk. We raised some points about this notion of the stranger and how I interpreted that role in terms of some of the positions that I've played and some of the roles that I've played regarding this notion of dealing with individual groups in conflict and some of the relationships between those, especially some of my experience between the deaf and the hearing cultures. Today what I want to do is I want to talk or I want to actually just simply present some ideas regarding the notion of power in groups and power in groups that are interacting with one another. Because I want to just set the frame for that, but I would like the interpretation to take place from you. So with the rich mix of experiences of individuals that we have here, I would like to hear something regarding interpretation from your side. So very quickly, because we've got some new folks in here, just to help us begin to get some understanding of where, once again, people are coming from, can we just go through the room real quickly? Just to find out a thumbnail sketch of who you are, and we'll move on quickly from there.
Yes. I'm not sure I'm in the right place, so could you tell me?
This is the dealing with the deaf and hearing cultures and conflict between.
Then I'm not in the right place.
Okay.
Which one are you looking for?
Gay, lesbian, open
floor. Oh, that's next door?
Thank you.
Okay. That's a good thing I asked.
You're in the right plane.
What?
You're in the right plane. Well, our group is significantly small. Why don't we, can we at least, do you need to be that far away? Or does it make any difference?
Why are there two types of signing going on?
Why are there two types of signing going on? That's a question. Who can respond to that?
Because in towards the back, they're doing a little bit more of American sign language, more conceptual nature. Because of some of the abstract topics that you're talking about, and here we're doing more English, you know, so that I can get more of the exact vocabulary. So here we're doing more English-based, and they're more concept-based than American Sign Language.
Okay. But they're both American Sign Language.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. It's both considered. So one is considered
not
direct
really.
English.
Here she's signing what probably call more pigeon signed English.
Okay.
PSE.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Good. Okay.
Good. Glad we found out. Okay. Let me put some ideas up on the board, and then let's take it from there. Because I can use ideas and I can use terms. How you want to be able to interpret them regarding some of the conditions you folks come from is really up to you, but I'd like to frame it. I'd like to frame it in in two different ways. First of all, more on a cultural level, because we spoke yesterday about the difficulty of being able to get cultures to come to a common arena as the only way that we know of being able to have them begin to deal authentically with some of the reality of the change that takes place. So if we can think of at least seven, and it's not even a question of stages in that they don't necessarily, one doesn't flow from the other, but they can and they may, but there's at least seven different ways in which we try to describe the set of interactions between two cultures. And I'm saying cultures in general because I want to put this up and then I want to see how it gets interpreted from whether it's a deaf or hearing context or whether it's from a pastoral context or okay. We always begin this notion that cultures or cultural interactions start with a sense of a minority-majority interaction. And as I cautioned yesterday, minority-majority, not in terms of necessarily numbers, but in terms of the concept of power primarily, right? Because there's all kinds of examples where you had the smaller numbered individuals who have got the greater amount of power, especially when you've got individuals or cultures, countries, areas where colonization has taken place. Seldom do you find the majority being the number with the largest group. We've talked about one aspect, first of all, that describes the interaction between those two minority-majority groups. And it is conflict. Conflict meaning that any time those two groups intersect with one another, it's considered to be a negative, and it's a series of contests. And in the contest, you have to be able to take it to the point where somebody wins and somebody loses. Now, when you have a loss, the idea is you remain in the majority as long as you can keep winning. The concept of conflict then in minority and majority is almost in all cases considered to be full of violence. Violence either physical or violence in a social or psychological way. Precisely because the domination of the majority is based on never losing. Okay? Never losing. Now, another concept. Subjugation. So that it's not conflict per se. The change, if you want to look at it, is instead of the sense of maintaining one's power by keeping the minority down, there now is the notion that, well, just like we need a series of resources in order to accomplish what we want, the minority group becomes a resource by themselves. So there needs to be some way in which that interaction or exchange takes place. The exchange being you, the minority, provide normally labor for the majority, and the majority then becomes more the majority because it is able to increase its own power simply by using you as a minority as a resource. This is also in a missionary sense, one of the very strong critiques of missionary services among many religions the constant critique that majority religions will go ahead and attempt to subjugate minority people and see them as a resource for their concept of religion, a resource for their concept of the saving of souls. So in the absence of a minority, they can't find individuals who are from a very point of view of give and take and producing of someone's power, minority. Because one of the outcomes of being subjugated is the majority is able to say, we are more powerful than others because we have more resources than somebody else. When a group that has been missionized or proselytized is seen as a resource, we're locked into that notion of subjugation between majority and minority. Third, segregation. Segregation meaning majority defines themselves as non-minority. So here the question is, let's keep them apart, there's no relationship. Here the relationship is that of a resource. In a segregated system, the majority define themselves as not the minority. And the minority are a threat to the majority, the majority's ability to maintain its set of power. So here you've got the minority are a threat. And you've got the majority defining themselves equals non-minority. Now, let's talk about this very briefly because segregation has a very interesting set of interactions. Because the difference between subjugation and segregation is that in the subjugation part, the majority needs to keep the minority in a condition that they're willing to give of their resources and their labor in order to be able to make the majority more powerful. In a segregation, the majority feel themselves separated from and in fact maintain their power by describing themselves as not minority. Clearly, most recent example on an international scale is South Africa and the apartheid notion of their power being precisely being not something else. And the minority are seen as a threat as opposed to the minority seen as a resource. Now, obviously, none of these things are pure, because you can have strongly segregated systems, and yet there's subjugation going on. So they are a resource and they are a threat simultaneously. That makes it very difficult to maintain and hold an ongoing community. Fourth, stratification. Stratification means the majority are ups and the minority are downs. By stratification, then, what you've got is in any condition where you have to figure how those two sets of individuals are going to interact with one another, stratification is a very clean way of defining social systems, because at any point in time when between the majority and the minority somebody gets more of something, or somebody is able to go ahead and seen as rising or going down, the minorities are the ones who are always put in the downed position, and the majority are always put in the up position. The stratification meaning not just that it's even, you've got the majority on one side and the minority on the other side. In stratification, what you like to do is put as many steps between the two of you. And so you have got this notion of this horizontal layering where you are keeping them apart. Stratification can be even a stronger separation of parties than even segregation. Because you can do stratification where you get no interaction at all. It is simply divided. And the other part about stratification is that it is very simple. You don't have to go through any machinations to figure out. It is simple identification. If you're a minority, you know that you get the less. If you're the majority, you get the up. If it's stratification in school systems, if you're part of the majority, you get access to the best, to the better educator. If it's by unquestioning, you know, same thing. Fifth, pluralism. Pluralism simply means all are able to maintain their identification. You get this notion of a community with a set of sub-circles, each allowed to be able to maintain its own culturalness. Traditionally, American society, in when people, especially Europeans, try to figure out what's happening in the Americas, quote, they will see the United States is built on segregation and stratification. They identify Canada as based on pluralism. And it's not simply just a idle kind of a concept. It is seen clearly in the policies developed in those two countries. Because in the United States, one of the strong messages we keep getting is this notion of assimilation. Because if you do this assimilation, you become, as a minority, you in fact lose your identity. So the intent of pluralism is different from assimilation. In fact, pluralism says we need to regard resources as ways for you to become and maintain as strongly identified with your minority status as you can. Assimilation, on the other side, says no, you order your resources in such a way that in fact the minority after a time simply is no longer seen. You can't identify them. Lastly, amalgamation.
But the deaf aren't assimilated.
The deaf are not assimilated. No, they are not assimilated. Amalgamation is a condition where both the majority and the minority lose their identity. Okay. Amalgamation is a threat. Okay. It's a most threatening thing to the majority because the fear is, by opening up the door to the minority, the majority, the concept that they have of themselves is now being threatened and won't be maintained. Assimilation then is seen as kind of a power modality of amalgamation. By that I mean assimilation still starts from the condition that the majority will not change, and that they would see themselves as so powerful and good that, of course, the minority wish to be like the majority. And that good minorities will become majority. The whole classical era of ancient Rome was established as this notion of assimilation, that when the barbarians came over the Rhine, the whole notion of being a good Roman was to be a good Roman. You learned Roman, you accepted Pax Romana, the peace of the Romans. You became more Roman like the Romans. And so, for instance, in France and Gaul and in Britain at times, they were more like the Romans than the Romans in Italy. Now, because there were these powerful conditions going on even at that time. I only mention that, so historically these have been rhythms that have been moving along. Okay, so we have these seven conditions: conflict, subjugation, segregation, stratification, pluralism, assimilation, amalgamation.
Can you share an example of the amalgamation?
Yes.
Historically, when that's happened?
Historically, we have amalgamation. Let's take Poland. Okay. Now, Poland is about as amalgamated as you can find, because they've been run over by just about every other group in Central or Eastern Europe at any one point in time. The idea of majority and minority has gotten so mixed that the ability to identify a poll is oftentimes difficult. For instance, you can go in the southern mountains of Poland and the Tatar Mountains, and there are Poles who look Asian, because they when the Mongols came across the plains and went through the central steppes and then through Europe and whatnot. The old structures that used to exist, because of all kinds of, not only because of their ability to take over and their numbers and their threats in terms of weapons, but it the blend was so exact that it's even difficult to go back and say what was a true pole or a true non-pole. And it got amalgamated to the point where it almost kind of gets confusing. The Poles have a joke. They say they've been run over so many times by different cultures and different people. They say, well, it's interesting because the Poles are the most polyglot people of anybody in the world. As a nation, they know more languages per person than anybody, if you just total them up. And the joke is, well, you need to know the language. It's nice to know the language of your friends, but it's absolutely necessary to know the language of your enemies. As just a signal, they've had so many enemies. That only comes to mind because when you say amalgamation, here's a group that's saying we need to be so prepared, even linguistically, to be able to solve this. Another one that comes to mind is my wife's culture, is the Philippines, as an amalgamated culture, where they are struggling in their own country, just trying to understand what does it mean to be Filipino. When I was there in 1992, they were talking in the University of the Philippines, UP, that they were beginning a special course on the psychology of Philippines as another course, as an attempt to be able to discover some of the
some of the psyche, so meaning what's the nature of their soul, rather than philosophically trying to understand it. And so there is a culture that is amalgamated to the point where when you see what is the majority and what is the minority, they are very Americanized because they've been colonized for close to 100 years by Americans, but they have been colonized for 400 years before that by the Spaniards. And so that has become so blended and interactive that it is truly that of an amalgam. So then when we talk about it, I look at your pictures and your family pictures, and so you, right, we can line them up. And she had a mother who looked very Spanish. She was a daughter. Her father comes from a Chinese and Filipino background, right, Claire? But all Filipinos, so that's an example. That's another example I can give. The historically, you can give some examples regarding just say organizations. It is a very difficult thing to go ahead and have mergers. Oftentimes, in organizational design, where they try to merge two companies or two banks or something like this. Normally, roughly only about a fourth of all those attempts ever work. And the reason the three-fourths don't work is not because of the mechanics of it. They don't work because they haven't been able to figure out how to bring the cultures together to come. Because they'll preach that really we want to be amalgamated. But what happens is somebody normally is in a majority condition, and somebody is in a minority condition, and so it lands up trying to look like stratification or segregation or subjugation, and it actually works this way till it just breaks out in that conflict, and then the merger falls apart in three out of four times. Okay, so enough of this as far as it is examples. Tell me, what is this? How do you see these things working? I guess that's really my question. How do you see these aspects of minority-majority power in some of the conditions that you folks find yourself working in and being caught up in?
I had an interesting experience living in Salt Lake City, where as a Lutheran, we bonded with Catholics and Jews and identified ourselves as non-Mormons. So the Mormon element was definitely majority.
Yep.
Everybody else, you identified yourself as non-majority.
Yes.
And the Lutheran schools were packed with Jews and Catholics to try to, you know, escape from the majority influence in the public schools.
Right. As a way to be able to go ahead and keep some sense of balance. Mm-hmm. You're not attempting to overthrow the majority, but you're trying to be able to maintain your at least some kind of identity with your own culture. In terms of the relationship then with the Mormon Church, though, was it in the normal social life, was it seen as stratification? Meaning, did you carry that kind of identification of being down or low?
It depended on the context. In the neighborhood, none of the children were allowed to play with my children because we were not Mormon. My children were not Mormon, and that was the neighborhood. In context of work, I worked at a Catholic hospital, so it didn't matter in that environment. In fact, one-to-one, it was just grand. Very, very wonderful, warm people, one-to-one. It just seemed that problems emerged when there was larger entities.
how does that hold on that your children were unable to their children didn't play with your children?
Right. Well, none of my children were in school yet. They were not school age yet. But they weren't allowed to play. Come over and play in our yard. They were invited. Mine were invited. They were prohibited from coming to play with mine.
Okay. And they survived well because they were able to go ahead and...
We got them together at church and other entities where they had a social life.
Okay. Does that still go on that way?
I wouldn't be surprised.
It does.
This was 15 years, 20 years ago.
And how about the other situations? Outside of, any other examples outside of the Mormon church?
Well, I shared an example yesterday a little bit, which is kind of a blend of these things. On one hand, coming from pastoring in the Eskimo church, there was a subjugation where the Eskimo was seen as a resource, people saved from their old religion. And at the same time, and also to enhance public relations and a sense of outreach into the whole world. And then in another way, the Eskimos were a majority who saw their pastor and other white people in the village as resources to them. So there was reverse subjugation. Very difficult situation. The National Church cutting back on its money to help support them in old patterns of dependency the need for creating a change or an environment for change where there could be a future that they would have, you know, be able to find a new future in the way between all of this.
Where do church systems normally begin? My background is I come from a Roman Catholic background. Here's a church that has been viciously missionary in the past, and with great subjugation of individuals, has had a kind of a very ruthless history in a lot of respects. But here and now, when we approach the idea of individuals who are either being attracted to or we attempt to attract into a church and build them as part of some kind of a community, you know, identifying them as strangers back to that first term. Which of these dynamics come into play?
It varies. Sometimes it's assimilation, sometimes it's subjugation. I think, like in our situation, it was strange in that the Eskimos literally welcomed Christianity because the shamans were very ruthless. And so they were able, in Christianity, to pick up on some of the elements that were in their old religion without having ruthlessness dumped on them. So there was a salvation, economic salvation, from these people who were taking advantage of them as their spiritual leaders.
Yeah.
So it was very mixed.
Yeah. There's an interesting example taking place. I just read in the paper a couple days ago, you've got the Episcopalians and the Lutherans coming together. Isn't that the case? Where they are going to have a common, quote, common communion, that they're going to go to the point where you have got, it reads like amalgamation. Are you familiar with that? And to the point where now they are saying that even individual and Episcopal cleric or priest can be a pastor for
a non-Episcopalian or for a Lutheran church, or a church is where they come together, both Lutheran and Episcopal, who have access to one of the two pastors, and that everything else, which I would guess would mean the sacramental aspect of it, is completely amalgamated. There they are, for all intents and purposes, there. I don't know enough about the intra structure of those two conditions that would say, you know, where's the power and where is the shift? It reads as if there are two coming together where neither of them were able or willing to define the other as a, quote, minority. They didn't wish to use them as a resource, per se. There was, in fact, an invitation for bounding.
Yes.
Yeah. On the surface, yes.
Yeah.
But the Episcopal Church is very proud of their but I don't know how you spell it.
No, I understand. The succession of bishops. The succession of bishops, yes.
Which the Lutherans... Yes, and how they get ordained.
Which the Lutherans did not have. Right.
Yeah, and the Lutherans don't, and the Lutherans don't feel that that's important and not necessary. So the Episcopalians seem to be coming to the table with the idea of bringing something, quote, better. That's just what I've gotten, you know, to talking with some Episcopalians.
Better. Oh, I see. So are you saying that the Episcopalians are coming in and saying, we're going to make it look like it's an amalgamation, but what it really is the Lutherans are able to...
We'll help those Lutherans.
I see. Yes.
But within the Lutheran tradition, there is an episcopacy as well, especially in the Scandinavian churches, so that we have a mixed heritage in that. So it depends on what part of the Lutheran church we're really talking about, even in this country, because the Lutheran church is an amalgamation of several previous Lutheran bodies that were more historically based in different countries. So,
in amalgamation, what you actually come out with is you come out with, you know, if you combine A and you combine B, you come up with C. Mm-hmm. As opposed to assimilation, which is when you combine A and you combine it with B, you come up with a big A. And that's why it's going to be intriguing to watch this interaction between us topics.
But in that, yes, there's a choice. And when you're talking about the deaf culture in regards to the speaking or hearing culture, are there choices to be had?
Put that to the rest of the folk in here. What is the choice? That there is. Would you repeat your question? Because I would really like Grace to hear that one as well.
All right.
Okay.
I heard the question.
Go ahead.
Would you also be willing to respond?
Okay. Go ahead. Well, my comment was that it seemed that in an amalgamation that there are choices in the matter. How in the deaf community and the hearing community, there don't seem to be the same ability to have choices toward an amalgamation.
Okay.
that some of the distinctions, are not a matter of choice in the matter.
Do you folks agree with that?
Or is it all?
Is it just following exactly? What are you saying? You're saying that we don't come to the table with the same choices because we don't hear because of our hearing difference?
I can make a choice as to whether or not I convert to be an Episcopalian or a Lutheran. Although I suppose God may argue with that. But if I were a deaf person, I could not choose suddenly to hear because of physiological basis. Mm-hmm. And that's a physiological barrier. It has nothing to do with my mind wishing or wanting it to be different. Maybe it's a matter of attitude than around whether or not I think it's a choice.
You do have some choice.
You do have a small, and maybe that's my perception is.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know if you're aware of, in the past, the historical place called Martha's Vineyard.
Yes. I've read the book.
You've heard about that. So many deaf are there, and they marry and interact and intermingle, and the island was involved with ASL deaf culture. I don't know what you call that. Is that number 7 or not? It seems to me that what I've heard about all of the people there accept each other, and they intermingle well, and that there's no real differences, you know?
Now, be careful. It's amalgamation doesn't mean that you still don't have any differences. Okay.
Ah.
So don't make that. There are still differences, all kinds of differences. The question is, are the differences of a magnitude that the majority positions the other party as the minority, or that the minority takes on the mantle of minority and supplies that interaction with the majority. Let me rephrase it. There's, when you look at minority-majority conditions, there are many conditions where, in fact, minorities will act precisely as a way to be able to maintain the majority in their role, meaning that there is a purpose for the minorities to maintain that status. Okay. So in other words, one of the difficult things of dealing with cultural change and cultural conflict is that, being human, we like to say, well, people are right or wrong or good or bad or up or down. And so you would assign to the majority all kinds of negative attributes because they are the majority, and the minority are good and righteous because they are being subjugated. Well, both of those attitudes are assigned to both of those conditions. So, and you cannot imply a value one way or another. So when it gets to the idea of differences, it's not attempting to take differences away. It is simply saying, I am not assigning that difference to my category of minority. Mm-hmm. Does that help?
It does, definitely.
Okay. So,
are you saying in having this 7 situations,
yep,
where there's power between factions, that amalgamation is the ideal?
No.
No. They're just...
It may not be the ideal precisely because the parties involved may not be ready to amalgamate. They may, in fact, have some real necessity to split apart and remain apart. There are conditions where, in order for minorities to become more powerful, they have to be able to reject the majority.
So these are not, I'm not laying these out as conditions that one is better than another. Each has a dynamic and a very complex one. But in terms of just trying to understand this complex set of interactions between minority and majority, at least being able to diagnose or assess a specific condition as one of these as opposed to another, or at least a tendency of one more than another, because they are oftentimes kind of, you know, blending and whatnot. But no, amalgamation is not the...
Where do you place, you know, social conflicts where, like she said, some people are born, they don't have a choice about their color, their height, their deafness, their blindness?
True.
How?
Let's take color as a condition in culture. Color and culture is only related to majority and minority based on whatever social or cultural or geographical historical frame you want to use. So it's not that our frame in the United States is constantly that of black and white, because historically that role has been. There are other places in this world, obviously, where color still has great effect on minority and majority stratification. Not a problem. But all those conditions are non-choiceful. You cannot choose to be non. I can't choose to be black. I can't, in terms of my skin color. What I can choose to do, though, is be in a society where not being white, whether it's black or yellow or green or whatnot, is simply not an assigning of that individual to a minority status. So the choice that I have is not to deny you your difference or deny, but it is simply to not accept that difference as a cultural cue. It goes back to something. Let me try this, because this is not... Go ahead. Okay.
Let me... because this is a Christian community.
Yeah.
let's talk about Christians and non-Christians.
Great.
As a big...
Yes.
Conflict, stratification, amalgamation. And how would we set that up? And obviously some churches may see it in different ways. But I mean, I'd be interested in the perspective of people here and how they see themselves, if they see themselves as Christians, as opposed to the non-Christians. Because we did talk a little bit about mission work.
Yeah.
And I think that's key in some ways, as to see what people see their mission is in the world, or the mission of those to whom they align. Mm-hmm. And feel free to be one of the respondents.
Pose your question. Can you be more precise? Can you give me a...
Yeah. In the area of minority-majority,
okay,
how do we picture 1 through 7, Christian, non-Christian?
Okay. All right. Well, you can take each one of those, obviously.
We can't amalgamate.
We can't amalgamate. We have great evidence of all those. We certainly have evidence of conflict, violence, killing one another under the name of God. Probably the most horrible tool in terms of our ability to kill one another has been the Bible and the Quran. It's been the justification. I was in the library last night and saw good old Saint Augustine again. You know, the Catholic saint person. He was a bishop of Hippo, outside of Carthage. He was from Africa, you know, but he laid the seeds for the Inquisition, basically saying,
if you're not Christian, it's okay to kill people, and it's okay to punch them for not being him. He wrote the philosophical justification in the 5th century of being able to slaughter one another for being not like me in terms of a Christianness. Okay.
Well, I know, historically, but I'm more interested in this group's perspective.
Okay. And so, well, let me back off, because I could run through each one of those and
right.
see current conditions.
I would like to know each of those for the current church.
Okay. Let's run through. Where's current conflict? Well, take whichever one you wish. Which one you want to take? Let's take stratification.
Born Lutheran and adult convert.
Okay. Are they treated the same?
Depends on the congregation.
Depends on the congregation.
Well, just to change my question a little
bit, okay.
I don't want a historical analysis, and my question is not to give examples of how things were misused.
Okay.
I'm looking at what it means.
Right now.
What is our interpretation, what it means to be a Christian, and there they are, or there they are, the non-guys, gals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, some examples of current conflict. What do you see?
In the ultimate sense.
Okay, and how about right now? Current contemporary world who we're sitting right now. What are some examples of current conflict between the Christians and non-Christians, or what is that?
Is that the question?
I'm not looking at examples of conflict. I'm looking, internal. Who's saved? Who's not safe?
I got you.
Are you okay?
You want to take
I'm okay. Mental. You're not okay. I'm looking at the ultimate sense of.
And you're looking at individual perspectives about this.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So there's the biblical perspective that some people will use that says no. There's only one name whereby we can be saved: Jesus Christ, our Lord. Like that.
Yeah. And 4/5 of the rest of the world
right.
or whatever.
True.
This is me. I am a Lutheran. And I think I'm probably the token Missouri Synod Lutheran. But I'm Lutheran. But in a much larger context, I'm Christian. And yet, in an even much larger concept, I'm a child of God. If I ever felt that God was constrained by any organization that we humans put together, I'd be pretty depressed about the scope of God's power. Because I feel very limited, and I think God's got so much more that I don't even know what's there. You understand?
So yeah.
That's why I don't get hung up about if you're non-Christian, that's bad. And partly because I'm an adult convert. And so I've known the other side. And I don't think I was particularly bad. Or nor do I feel that some of the people that were not converted are not God's children. And maybe that makes me not a good Lutheran or a good Christian, but I just have to believe that God's got is a greater being than what we want to categorize him to be.
I think we're dealing with a subject that is as individual as each person, because, for instance, there's the universalism, which is what I'm hearing you mm-hmm. say, and then there's the particularism. And, you know, if we look, for instance, at the Great Commission, go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name, you know, blah, blah, blah. there's the particularization. So I think that if we ask where are we at today, we are in different places today. And there are some Christians in one place who are here or in this room, and some people who are in other places. And so to ask for one place, I think, is hard to do.
The Christians you deal with, do they consider themselves a majority or minority?
Both.
Both.
I would agree.
Explain that to me.
But we're in a society where to be a Christian is not what it used to be even 20 years ago, where the sanctions in day-to-day life within a general community are not as pro-Christian, where to be a Christian now takes a little more courage to walk as a Christian openly. I'm thinking, for instance, when I was in Portland, Maine, starting a congregation there, that the prejudice I received as a Christian that I never knew would exist, coming from even the Midwest. So I think that it is something that is changing, that we can be in a majority if we're in a Lutheran area, but if we look at the overall culture, we're a minority as Lutherans and as Christians. Mm-hmm. Look at, for instance, the culture of television, or the culture of the general media of any kind. The Christian perspective is not the common perspective.
What do you think is the common perspective?
Hedonism.
Hedonism is not necessarily not Christian, though. Or am I wrong?
Talk about your definition of hedonism.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Any dictionary.
Hedonism simply meaning the
your cast.
Your,
I'm sorry.
Okay. Hedonism simply meaning the idea of the pursuit of what you want and what feels good prior to some other higher or loftier.
That Christianity says pursuit of what God wants.
Okay. And if part of what you define, if part of the scope, here's my point. The notion of Christianity by itself, okay, I think is still caught in a vacuum where the notion of hedonism, meaning there is some need to be able to go ahead and some need higher right now than what someone else may wish me to get. Christianity sometimes is described in such a way that we can do things to other people, or we can usurp some of their prior strengths and who they are, based on a calling from someone else.
But then we're talking about religion as over against a faith. I mean, religion can end up being an umbrella for lots of different reasons for doing all kinds of things, including slavery and everything else. But when we talk about a faith in God, you know, the God that we espouse, I think, within the general Lutheran stance is a God of compassion and love and mercy. And that, you know, to live alongside God in that is to be a people with compassion, love, and mercy, and so on, reconciliation and healing. So, what is Christianity comes
right
into being the question then.
I think, right.
Because I think,
and I know,
it gets misplaced, and it's a very vague term anymore. because...
But that faith in God, if you were born Muslim, you were born Buddhist, or born...
The triune God, excuse me. The triune God. The God that acknowledges Jesus Christ as
no,
the one who died on the cross.
Christians from the others, yeah. But what I personally believe is that if you were born Buddhist and you have a faith in God in your own context, and play that part of your faith faithfully as a good Buddhist, there's nothing wrong with that. You will be saved as well, because there are many paths to salvation.
That's a Buddhist belief too, but not necessarily a Christian belief.
I know it's not
very
Christian.
Definitely not.
But it's so that is a minority belief.
Depending on where you live.
No. But let's just take the fact that 4/5 of the world is not Christian. Let's say it's more than the majority. The majority of the world is not Christian.
Right.
Okay. So that notion that the only people who are saved are quote Christians is a minority belief.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.